Okay, we're starting today our study of Parshat Noach. To kind of recap and also build into the beginning of Parshat Noach. So we discussed in Parshat Bereshit, we saw that Adam and Chava ate from the Eitz HaDa'at Tov V'Ra, and this brought about the creation of Bechira Chofshit, of free will as we know it. And from that moment onwards, humanity could fully connect with Tov and fully connect with Ra. In the last year, we took it even deeper than that, and we discussed how it enmeshed Tov and Ra into each other, leaving humanity in a state where we almost always have conflicting motivations of Tov and Ra in everything that we do. That it's not just connecting to Tov or connecting to Ra, but there's a da'at between Tov and Ra, there's a union, there's a connectivity between Tov and Ra, which builds within us conflicting motivations even within our actions. At that point, Adam and Chava were able to be sent out of Gan Eden with free will as we know it in place and with the charge to go into the world, assumably to choose Tov over Ra. Is that how things go? No, not at all. It's clearly not what happens. Already in the children of Adam and Chava, we see Ra expressed in Cain and Tov expressed in Hevel. Cain actually goes and kills Hevel, and we literally begin to see the destruction of Tov at the hands of Ra overcoming Tov. We saw this continued into the story of Lemech, who embraces his selfish desires, taking a wife purely for the purposes of physical pleasure, in addition to a wife for the purposes of Pru-Revu, and that union even accidentally produces a child, whose name Tuval Kain, whose whole reality that he brings to the world is that he's the one to create weapons of war, and accidentally kills Cain himself, coming back to Cain himself. Things continue to spiral downward over Parshat Bereshit, and we see the emergence of the first forms of Avodah Zarah in the world in the times of Enosh, recognizing the fact, I put it here for myself, because we didn't have time to really develop the issues of Dor Enosh and the immensity of that of Avodah Zarah. It's the first ever Avodah Zarah to emerge in the world. Even more than that, what makes it so crazy, quoting you from the end of Perek Dalet in Parshat Bereshit, that the genealogy here is not so far. Vayida Adam od et ishto. So Adam and Chav had another relationship, Vatelet Bain, and they had a child, Vatikrat Shemo Sheit. Sheit is the child of Adam and Chava, and it says here, meaning basically they had another child in place of Cain. They lost Cain and they produced Sheit. And then Sheit has a child. L'Sheit hu gam hu yulad bein. He has a child and his name was Vayikrat Shemo Enosh. So you have Adam, Sheit, Enosh. We're two generations removed from Adam HaRishon. We're the way that, I'll quote him a couple of times, there's a Rav in KBY who shares some very, very deep things about issues in Sefer Bereshit that a friend of mine gave me, you know, the ability to listen to those shiurim. But they're not public, so I don't know if I can quote him or quote it, so I'll just mention it as like that. But he says, like when Enosh sat on Adam's knee, his grandfather's knee, and he says to him, but who's your Abba? And so what did Adam say? God. Okay, who's your mommy? What'd he say? God. Like, this is who Enosh was. This is two generations removed from Adam HaRishon. Adam, Sheit, Enosh. Two generations, and yet despite that, and one has to understand the immensity of the nature of that Avodah Zarah, the choices that were made, and why they were made. But immediately then, az huchal likro b'shem Hashem, and the Mefarshim understand az huchal milashon chulin, chilul Hashem. They took out any meaning from shem Hashem. Says Rashi, az huchal likro et shmot ha'adam. Then they began to call the names of man, vet shmot ha'atzabim, and the names of idols b'shmo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That was the emergence of Avodah Zarah. La'asotan Avodah Zarah, likrotan alokutim, to call them godliness. Two generations removed. We've got Shvichut Damim with Cain and Hevel. We've got Avodah Zarah and Dor Enosh. What's left? Gil Arayos. And that's where everything finally comes crashing down. The final straw is Gil Arayos. You can open up in your source sheets to source number one. You can take a look, preferably in your Chumashim, the beginning of Perek Vav. Vayhi ki hechel ha'adam larov al pnei ha'adamah uvanot yildu lahem. man continued to spread out upon the face of the earth, and they had many daughters. Vayiru b'nei ha'elohim et b'not ha'adam, ki tovot heina. Vayichu lahem nashim b'kol asher bacharu. The b'nei ha'elohim, there's obviously two different ways to understand that. The simple pshat and the primary pshat of Rashi is the b'nei ha'sarim v'ha'shoftim. Not like the, there are midrashim that bring down b'nei ha'elohim, that there were malachim who are coming down and getting involved in humanity, and that there's a layer there also. But sticking with Rashi's original pshat, and the simple pshat here is that the b'nei ha'elohim, the sons of the noblemen, people who were living in the fancy houses, the people who were coming from the you know, the higher end neighborhoods. Yes. Enter from the higher. the higher end neighborhoods. So they would come down. And they would go and they would look at the benot ha'adam, meaning the regular people, the regular, these girls that were around. Ki tovot heina, and again, the same individual from KBY points out, the real issue here, he talks about the difference between beauty and attraction. That beauty is objective. He saw, ki tovot heina, they saw that they were good. What does that mean? They were good for me. Purely objectifying those women. They came to a place of pure objectification, looking singularly for nothing else than to serve their own pleasures. And therefore, and they took for them wives from anybody that they wanted. And it's clear where that's headed. So the Mefarshim bring it out. First he says, Kitavotena. Rashi first brings down all this from Chazal. Kitavotena, that they would go and they would see brides beautifully done up in their makeup and dressed up for their wedding day, and they would go and take them and they would be with them before they would be able to go to their chuppah. Mikol asher bacharu, af bulat ba'al, it didn't matter if the person was married, af azachar, it didn't matter if it was homosexuality, va'abehima, bestiality, it didn't matter. That was where this generation degenerated to. If it looked good, they wanted it and they took it. And it's that complete immersion in going after physical desires and the pleasures of this world that spirals the world out of control to the point. And now we get really to the preface of our parasha. Source number 3 is the continuation of the. It's the next paragraph and the final paragraph of Parashat Bereishit. Vayar Hashem ki raba ra'at ha'adam ba'aretz. At that point, God saw that evil was tremendous in the land. And the yitzer of the minds and the hearts of the people was ra ra kol hayom. We had reached a state of ra. What had won in our battle that we started out with at the beginning of Bereishit? Ra. In the battle between Tov and Ra, Ra had overcome. Vayinachem Hashem ki asa ta'adam ba'aretz v'itasev libo. And God regretted, whatever that means, that God can regret, and the Mepharshim have to deal with that, that God regretted having created man. Vayitasev libo, and he became sad. Vayomer Hashem emche ta'adam asher barati mi'al panei ha'adama. I'm going to totally wipe out man that I created on the face of the earth. Me'adam ad behima ad remes v'ad ova shamayim. From man to beast to crawling creature to the birds in the sky, because I regret having made him in the first place. And the little glimmer of hope that Parshat Bereishit ends off with is the Noach matzachin ben Hashem, that Noach had chen in the eyes of God. Now let's come back to this last paragraph, which again really sets up our story of Parshat Noach. All of this did, and we're going to come back to this narrative of Bereishit and how it leads into Noach, and how Noach potentially solves the problems that arose over the course of Bereishit. But think about it for a second. Vayar Hashem ki raba ra'at ha'adam ba'aretz lechol yitzer machshavot libo rak rakol hayom. Vayinachem Hashem ki asa ha'adam ba'aretz. God sees that man became so evil that there was nothing to do but wipe them out. What's problematic about that? Does that sound strange to you? No, you're like, it's all good. You shook your head.
Why not before also, why do you get to this point?
The way that my Rebbe frames it, just to shift it a little bit, is is there seems to have been a plan. And it seems like things aren't going, quote-unquote, according to plan. The problem with that is that what does that mean for God to have a plan and for things to not go, quote-unquote, according to God's plan? How does that work? What does that mean? How do things get to a point where God has to wipe everything out? And how do things go off track from what God intended? Those are human terms. Those are human concepts. Things don't go against the plan of God. What's happening here? And yet it does seem like, I mean, that's the way some seem to put it, is that Ra overcomes. That was never the intention, quote unquote. And so God, again, quote unquote, has no choice but to wipe man out. To destroy the world with a flood. What does that mean? Let's deepen the question by shifting to Pesukim in Parshat Noach itself. Skip forward to Perek Chet, Pasuk Yirchet, when Noach leaves the Teva after the Mabul. Source number 4 in your sheets as well. So Noach and his children and his wife, they all left the Teva. And all the animals also come out of the Teva. And he brings a tremendous number of korbanot to HaKadosh Baruch Hu when he's finally able to leave the Teva. Vayarach Hashem, focus on this pasuk. This is going to be our key pasuk. Vayarach Hashem et reach hanichoach. Hashem smells this beautiful aroma of these korbanot. Vayomer Hashem alibo, and God says in his heart, Lo osif od lekalel od, lo osvi, lo osif lekalel od et ha'adama ba'avor ha'adam. I'm not going to curse the ground. I'm not going to destroy the world anymore because of mankind. Why? Ki yitzer lev ha'adam ra min urav. Because the nature of man's heart is evil from his youth. It won't erase and destroy the entire world as it did before. And even goes so far then as to bring this into a brit, and the form of the brit is the rainbow, the keshet, to signify that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will never again destroy the world like he did in the times of Noah. Putting these two together, what's now problematic about God's guarantee about never destroying the world? Man seems to still be evil. Basically, we're caught, Larry puts it in a mimanafsha, the way that the Gemara puts it. I'm caught between both, either way I go, I'm stuck. Meaning, either you have to say that God is making it, I have to say that God realizes, maybe after the flood, that destroying the world wasn't justified. And since it wasn't justified, he's saying, no matter what happens, even if man becomes ra to that extent again, I won't bring him a bull. But how could you say that? That means that what? He's looking back at the fact that he destroyed the world and he was wrong? Or you say, no, God does know that he was justified. Of course he was justified in destroying the world. He's God. He knows what he's doing. In which case, how can he make such a promise? Because if man does become that ra again, then what should be the response? A mabul. How do we know? Because that's what he did the first time. So how can God make such a guarantee? How can he say, I'm never again going to bring a flood to destroy the world? Either that means that he felt that he wasn't justified the first time, or he can't make such a guarantee because he should bring it another time if we get to that place of wrath. Either way, you're stuck. So what we want to do is try a way to address these two questions that arise from the psukim that we looked at. One is, what does it mean that it seems like things weren't going according to plan? And two is, how can God make such a guarantee afterward? Either he wasn't justified, which is impossible, or he was justified and he couldn't have made the promise never to bring a mabul again. How do we understand this? So I want you to take a look very carefully at two psukim that we read and see if you can find the nuanced difference between them, that within that word, we'll be able to unpack the answer to this question. Take a look at Bereshit, Perek Vav Pasuk Hei, the end of Bereshit, and compare it to Perek Chet Pasuk Chaf Aleph. I'll read them to you. See them inside in the text. Perek Vav Pasuk Hei. Vayar Hashem ki rabba ra'at ha'adam ba'aretz v'chol yitzer machshevot libo rach ra kol hayom. As opposed to Vayarach Hashem et reach hanichoach vayomar Hashem libo lo osif v'kalel odet ha'adama ba'avor ha'adam ki yitzer lev ha'adam ra mine'urav v'lo osif od l'hakot et kol hachai et kol chai asher asiti. What happens in that second pasuk that perhaps we can latch on to the chip things? Yeah, Margalit?
No, it's
true. True, it's a difference. Give me a word that's going to change things, though.
Ni'urav.
That's a word that creates a relative difference. The first time we had, the kol yitzer machshavot libo rak ra kol hayom. It's a very intense pasuk. That the entire yitzer of the minds and the hearts of people was rak ra, only rak kol hayom, all the time. And there is something that seems to shift post mabul. It says ki yitzer lev ha'adam ra mi ne'urav. That the yitzer of the heart of man is ra from his youth. So the question then becomes, what is so significant about this difference between ra ra kol hayom and rami ne'urav? Why is one a justification for demolishing the world and one an explanation for why the world will never again need to be destroyed? You want to take a crack at it?
I have a thought, but my whole thought kind of negates it. Basically, like, children are born innocent, and an innocent child can't necessarily be ra. But if we're ra as a nar,
right, so we're going to flip it on its head.
That's what I'm saying. Like,
so let's
see what I'm saying.
Yes.
Like, it kind of negates what I was going with.
When we talk about Nirim, we're talking more of post-bar and bat mitzvah, in that age of youth and adolescence, not necessarily from a child, but from their youth, from the earlier stages, and we'll unpack that right now. The Mishnah Pirkei Avot, I put it on your sheet just so you would see it, but it's a well-known Midrash in Pirkei Avot, I'm not going to look at the whole thing right now, it says that there were 10 generations from Adam to Noach. Asara dorot me'adam ad Noach. In Parshat Bereshit, the Torah is telling us that over the course of those 10 generations, humanity descended into a state of rak ra kol hayom. However, later on in our parsha, in Parshat Noach, the Torah qualifies that those 10 generations are somehow the ne'urim stage of human history. It's the stage of youth of mankind as a whole. What the Torah is telling us is that there is a parallel between the stages of development of all of mankind and the maturing process of every single person in their own olam katan. I have my own personal, unique maturing process. Each one of us does. And that the maturing process of each human being is parallel to the maturing process of humankind as a whole over the course of human history. In the first 10 generations of human history, we're still deep in the Ne'urim stage of history, in the youth stage of human history. So what's the nature, what's the content of this stage of Ne'urim? So the Torah defines it, as we keep coming back to it. Lover youth. It's a reality, the Ne'urim stage is a reality of Ra, Ra, Kol Hayom. Ra completely takes over, both on a level of the individual and on a level of human history. The Ne'urim stage, and this is in the not too distant past for most of us, hopefully. Hopefully it's in the distant past. That was not clear. It's for all of us, and for most of us in this room, it's going to be in the distant past. My hope is that it is in the past and not in the present, which if you're in the room is probably true. The Ne'urim stage is a time where there's no self-discipline, where there's no ability to delay gratification, no self-control. The Ne'urim stage is a stage of entirely selfish existence. And again, everyone goes through Ni'urim. We all experience it on one level or another and to differing degrees relative to who we become as adults. Again, it's a time of a lack of self-discipline, a lack of ability to delay gratification, and a search to fulfill physical pleasures with no sense of consequence whatsoever. It's only later on that a person recognizes the need to take control of their lives and to create limits and boundaries. I was thinking about the fact that I had a flash of when I was studying in college, psychology. I found a little excerpt here, but I remember this being something which we learned in, I think, I'm assuming developmental psychology, that actually it does parallel itself even physiologically in the body, which needs to be so, right? Because the physical body is only a manifestation of a spiritual reality. And as far as I know, at least from that time and from when I did a quick search on the internet, the same thing came up. I don't know if science has changed, but it makes sense that during youth and adolescence, the frontal lobes, which is home to key components of the neural circuitry underlying quote-unquote executive functions, such as planning, working memory, and impulse control, they're among the last areas of the brain to mature. It's built into us physiologically because it's part of who we are spiritually. That those are the last things to come along. That the Ni'urim stage is a stage of a lack of impulse control, a lack of planning, a lack of a sense of consequence. And we see that in youth and we see that in adolescence all the time. When one is within the Ni'urim stage, one is in a reality of Ra Ra Kol Hayom. Ra has completely taken over. And that's why it's seen as, that's why it's seen as Ra Ra Kol Hayom. It's not relative, it's all that one knows. And when it's in the Ni'urim stage, that's the experience. The experience is Ra Ra Kol Hayom. Only once then one has stepped out of the Ni'urim stage, once one has wiped out the Ni'urim stage, which our parsha indicates can only happen on some level through a mubble process for the world and somehow in every individual as well, then one can look back at the previous stage and redefine it as Ra Minirav. Only with the value of hindsight, only once we're past it, can we look at the previous stage as a stage and say, no, it was Ra Minirav. While I'm in it, I'm experiencing Ra Ra Kol Hayom. I have no basic comparison. But once I step out of it and cleanse myself and move past it, once the world cleanses itself and moves past the Ni'urim stage, then it's able to look back retroactively and say, it's Ra, it's Kulo Ra, but it's Ra Minirav. Again, the word Ni'urim itself implies that it's a stage, and one that mankind can grow out of. Taking things one step further, the very fact that Ni'urim is a stage in the history of mankind, and the fact that Ni'urim is a stage in every single person individually, implies that there's a certain inevitability of Ni'urim. Every human being goes through youth and adolescence as a natural part of their development. It's part of life. We don't say that, like, something is wrong with this child when they enter that stage. We do our best when children reach the stage of adolescence to help them navigate it as best as possible and to slowly work with them to move beyond it, to create limits, to create boundaries, to impose impulse control, to create self-control, to have that cognition and that planning. We try to work with them to create those realities, but we don't think there's something wrong with a kid who doesn't have that yet. That's part of the natural stage of life. It's an inevitable part of the process towards maturity. If we assume, and we see with our own eyes, that Ni'urim is an inevitable process in each and every individual, that youth and adolescence is an inevitable part of every individual, then so too is youth and adolescence going to be an inevitable component of the history of mankind as well. This inevitability of the Urim stage in the context of human history answers the difficulties that we opened with, of things seemingly not going quote-unquote according to plan, or God promising that he will never again bring another Mabul. In a post-Gan Eden world, there seems to have been an inevitability of Ra taking over. The Urim stage needed to emerge and needed to be wiped away, washed away with the Mabul. Then, once it was washed away, and the world progressed beyond its Ne'urim stage, God was able to guarantee that the world would never need another Mabul to destroy the world. There were some confused faces on that one. Meaning, we said before, how could it be that things didn't go according to plan? The answer is no. There was an inevitability of Ra taking over. Kadosh Baruch Hu, understandably, was upset about that. Kadosh Baruch Hu had to come to a choice to wipe it out, to remove that Ra, and to move the world from its Ne'urim stage, its youth and its adolescence, to a place of maturity. But that wasn't what, quote-unquote, God wanted, but it was a necessary part of the development of human history. And on the flip side, once God has, through the process of the Mabul, washed away the Ne'urim stage of history, then once we come out the other side, he can make a guarantee that he will never destroy the world again, because Ra will never get to that extent again. Because the Ne'urim stage is behind us. I saw when I was doing my own reading, my own learning in Parshat Noach, some very beautiful explanations that hint at a contradiction here, but I think that they can be lined up well enough that I think it's fascinating and beautiful and I think should be incorporated, is that that's the nature of the Brit Keshet itself. That the Brit on not destroying the world again comes in the form of a rainbow. And there were a few different deep, deep explanations that I saw. One layer of what I saw in my learning was that originally there was a whole circle, so to speak. There was an ability for humanity to sink to a level where it could wholly destroy the world, where it could wholly immerse itself in Ra. The fact that the Brit is made on a keshet is only half of a circle, meaning it shows that there was an imposition of borders and boundaries on the world. The way that the Sfarim that I saw framed it is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it seems, imposed a limitation on free will at that point, so that mankind would never get to a place where it would be rock kol hayom. To fit it into our narrative, which I think it certainly can, is that no, the rainbow is a natural reflection of the fact that now that the world has matured to a new place, it's now a world that exists where there will always be an inherent sense of borders and boundaries because we've wiped away the Ne'urim stage of history. And so that rainbow reflects the new reality of this new mankind that emerges from the Teva. It was the Ori d'Alyahu there who pointed out also that there are suddenly a lot of new gvulim that are imposed. The Torah notes Kites and Koref, that the seasons are much more fixed, that the years of the human being get limited to a smaller and more specific number of years, that as we move on, there's more of a sense of borders and boundaries to the world, I would say, because humanity has progressed post the Mabul. So whether you want to see it as God limiting it or God reflecting the limitations of the world in a post-Mabul reality, either way is fine, but the first one fits into our narrative, and it's a beautiful understanding of why Dafka, the rainbow, the Keshet, is relevant there. Though I can't help myself to say in parentheses that we're skipping over a lot of things that we're going to be coming back to again and again and again over our learning. When we have more information, we'll be adding more content to Noah, to the sin of Dor HaMabul, and to even potentially the Keshet itself. Hold out. Show self-control. We will, over time, later this semester, and then even towards the end of next semester, it's going to be a while, we'll continue to develop, and we have more tools, more terms, more concepts. We're actually going to keep on retroactively building into the beauty of what's happening in the story of Noach and what's going on there. All of this seems really horrible. There's this Urim stage of Rak, Ra, Kol, Hayom, of evil totally taking over. And we said that it seems to be an inevitable stage in humanity of adolescence before adulthood, and an inevitable stage for the world of an Urim stage before we move on to the next stage. So one can simply ask the question, why have an Urim stage at all? If it's a stage of complete Ra and needs to be totally wiped out, why create an Urim stage in the first place? So the Rebbe puts it that the answer is that this is the price of free will. This is the price of free will. God could have created a world without free will. A simple world without Tov and Ra. And you know what? It would have been a totally meaningless existence. The most fundamental aspect of our humanity in this world, in Olam Hazeh, and what elevates us and makes us the centerpiece of creation in this world, is our Bechira Chofshit. The price of free will and having the ability for people to meaningfully make their own choices is to create Tov and Ra, and more than that, to accept that there will be a stage where Ra will prevail first. That's simply the nature of things. If Tov and Ra are allowed to exist freely, Ra will always prevail first. It's always easier to be pulled toward Ra. Ra doesn't require any work. One simply has to give in to one's natural physical desires. Right? If one sees something tasty, so they go and eat it. If they see something that they want to look at, they go and they gaze at it. If they want to go and connect with someone, they go and connect with them. It's very easy to follow Ra, to follow the inclinations of one's selfish desires. And because that's the easy route, the simple route, the natural route, so Ra will prevail first, because it doesn't require any work. Ra is a byproduct of letting things run unchecked and uncontrolled. There's no sense of responsibility or thinking before taking action. On the flip side, Tov is the exact opposite. And Tov, therefore, is much more difficult. Tov requires real work, attention, and intention to acquire Tov and true self-control. And that's something that takes time and maturity to achieve. Rebbe pointed out very beautifully. He says that while this stage, again, it's difficult and it's painful, that it seems necessary, even in a way that's it's very powerful. Think about the following. Usually the way that life works is that when the need for something in life arises, God provides what is needed. When a child is born, the mother produces its sustenance. The two come hand in hand. Meaning the second that something arises in the natural world, its response also arises in the natural world. One of the things that seems to be in direct contrast to that is the Mishnah and Pirkei Avot. The Mishnah and Pirkei Avot says that ideally, certainly in their times, ben shmona esrei l'chupa, that a person is supposed to get married at what age? 18. So by us, it's a few years later that we start the process. Fine. But it's ideally, according to Chazal, 18. Let's even move it back to 18 and it still works. It's fascinating that the capacity within a human being to reproduce begins years before that. The second that an animal has the ability to reproduce, what does it go and do? It goes to reproduce. And yet, HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems to have designed humanity with a gap, where we mature physically in a way where we're ready to reproduce at a much younger age. From 18, 5, 6 years beforehand. And yet, the ideal time, according to Chazal, for marriage seems to be 18, which means that it's built into the process of humanity. That we're supposed to have this time where the potential is supposed to manifest, where our physical desires on all levels of being are supposed to try to take hold of us. And the goal of that time, which is the time of youth and adolescence, the time of Ne'urim, the goal of that time is to have that potential and to learn to exert self-control, to pull back on one's physical impulses, and to not run after one's physical desires. But it's an incredible thing that's built into the process itself. Coming back to this concept that, again, if it's built into the process, that if we have Ra and Tov, that Tov is going to inevitably overcome first, there are many different manifestations of this. Darkness always comes before light. We can see that reflected in Vayihi Erev, Vayihi Voker. The darkness always precedes the light. Chaos always precedes order, which we also see in the way that, as you think back to a Chazal that we're going to go back to again and again and again, the different stages, the three stages of the 6,000 years of history. The first 2,000 years, 2,000 years of... What do we say? The first 2,000 years, 2,000 years of... Tohu, chaos. And then there's 2,000 years of Torah, which somehow seems to then imply that that's the imposition of self-control, planning, thought, intentionality to the world, which makes sense inherently. We'll be obviously developing that over time. But Tohu comes before Torah. Mikubalim use a lot the mashal, which we see in the physical world, the fact that the peel always comes before the fruit. There's no fruit in existence where the fruit is on the outside and the peel is on the inside. You always have to break through the shell, the peel, in order to get to the fruit within. The only way to get to the fruit of maturity is to break through the peel of the selfishness of youth. It's all the same concept. And this transition from Ne'urim to maturity does not happen automatically. There are many people in this world, I'm sure we can all think of examples in our own lives, there are many people in this world who remain in the Ne'urim stage well into their adult lives. You don't just quote-unquote grow out of it. You have to build yourself out of it. You have to get out of the Ne'urim stage. A person could be well into their 30s, 40s, and 50s and still have the maturity and self-control of an adolescent. We see it in people in our own lives, I'm sure, or people we're not close to, people who we know. We certainly see it all over the place in the news all the time. But there are many people who choose to remain in a state of Ne'urim. They could stay in a state of Ne'urim until they're dead. They could never leave that stage. They could never purify themselves and actually mature in a meaningful way. The length of the Ne'urim stage, and whether one progresses past it at all, is up to the work of each individual. This is what was happening in the Dor HaMabul. Let's bring it back into our whole narrative from Bereshit and all the way until now. We saw Kain kill Hevel. We even saw the emergence of Avodah Zarah in Dor Enosh. When do things go off the rails to the point where God needs to destroy the world? When we get to the point of totally giving in to a reality of one's physical desires. The paragraph that precedes the decision to destroy the world is when the B'nai Elohim go down toward the B'nota Adam, Ki Tovot Heina, Vayichu Lehem Hashem B'kol Asher Bacharu. Once they've totally got off the rails and totally immersed themselves in Ra, when they've embraced that side of themselves that's totally focused on filling their selfish desires, then HaKadosh Baruch Hu is finally, that's the end. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu needs to destroy the world and wipe out that adolescent lack of self-control, totally involved in one's physical desires. That needs to be totally wiped out so the world can start to move toward its reality of maturity. You move forward to the first paragraph of Parshat Noach. So much of the nuances of the Pesukim are hinting to the fact of a lack of control in the areas of Arayot specifically. It's true that Chazal say that the thing that literally the straw that broke the camel's back was Gezel. But it was this combination of Arayot, which there was another sefer that I saw who actually put this in a footnote. Because you have to deal with the fact that the issue of the Dor HaMabul was Arayos. And yet Chazal say that it was Gezel that pushed them over the top. So he says, yes, Gezel pushed them over the top because the Arayos was so bad that Gezel was the final straw. But why is Gezel the final straw? Because there it's saying that literally it doesn't matter. We're so far beyond having any sense of control, it doesn't matter.
This was yours? I don't care. It's mine now. I have no respect for you. I don't care who you are. I don't care that this was yours. Now it's mine. No borders. No boundaries. But then it was. But Gezel is the farthest reach of that. Is it's forget it. Forget about the fact that they were sinning against God, and that they couldn't care less about what God wanted them to take and not to take, what God wanted them to be involved in or not involved in. There was no respect, no care for each other. Desire and fulfilling one's impulses was the only thing left. Was the pasuk. There was nowhere else to go. And at that point, the world needs to be wiped out. That was the end. And so the Mabul comes, and again, washes away the sins of youth, washes away the youth stage of humanity. If you want, and again, these concepts will come back later on, but what does it sound like when the whole world is submerged in water? Like a what? Like a mikvah? Kadosh Baruch Hu dunks the world into a mikvah and allows it to emerge anew, be reborn anew, ready to enter into a new world of maturity. Who is going to be the one to define what that new world looks like? Noach. And not just Noach, but Noach and? Not just Shem. Shem, Cham, and Yefet. And that's immediately where the Torah turns to afterward. So what we're going to do next time is, now that we have, in theory, foreshadowing, in theory, washed away all of the sins of youth, all of the Ne'urim stage of humanity, we're now going to examine the three branches that extend from the new humanity. We have to understand who are Shem, Cham, and Yefet, and in what way do they set the stage? In what way are they the building blocks, the pillars, upon which the new post-Mabul world will be built? Bezrat Hashem, when we come back after Sukkot, we will pick up with that and begin to understand the new world post the Mabul.